Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Artie Shaw performing Stardust. He was born on this day in 1910. We're about to talk to Walter Mosley, who, of course, is the author of more than 43 critically acclaimed books, a bestseller series featuring E.Z. Rawlins, the incredible characters he has brought us over the years that we've all fallen in love with. He's brought us a new one to add to that pantheon. His work has been translated into 23 languages, literary fiction, science fiction, short fiction, stuff about politics, For the Nation, New York Times, all the rest. O. Henry Award, Grammy, Pan America's Lifetime Achievement Award. And I think that's enough to talk about. The interview's over. No, it's not. Walter, welcome.
How you doing, Mark?
How are you?
Great.
So we're here to talk about the newest book, Debbie Doesn't Do It Anymore. Is this the first time that a woman has been the central character?
It's in a novel. Yeah, I've written a couple of short stories about women, but this is the first time a woman is a central character, and I did first person narrative from her point of view.
And it's also, I mean, I love this. This book is. I was just reading it all the last couple of days over this weekend, and I started reading it as soon as I got it, but then put it down and picked it up just before we to have this interview. And I love this character. I also like it. Made me think of something that I was thinking about my mother. I'm saying that sounds silly, but there's reasons why. But and I one of the things that I wrote down was that my mother in her life taught me that our greatest flaws live side by side with our deepest beauty.
I like that. I don't even know if it's true, but it sounds great.
But I think this is this character.
No, it's true. I think that her strength, her weakness, and her talent or beauty is all together, in one package, moving forward in the world kind of amazingly. And I think that that's not only true for her. I think it's true for many of us.
So talk. I mean, where did this come from for you? I mean, the woman who battling her way out of porn and into this new life, which we can talk about it a bit. And I'm going to read a few things and ask you to read something you really feel deeply about in this book. But where did this come from?
It came from the title. I forget even when. It was like over 10 years ago. I was talking to somebody and they said something. I said, well, Debbie doesn't do it anymore. And then I went, wow, wait, that's a great title. And it just stayed with me all this time.
So this character, though, I mean, a woman who spent her life in porn, and it's the story that you lay down for us is one that I think is not really uncommon in some ways in terms of how young women get sucked into this trade, but then it becomes a life.
And men.
And,
really, it's women and men. And it's even more interesting because, women and men get sucked into the trade because of their history, because of their needs, because of ability, because of lack of money, whatever. And then you have all these people who, buy it and sell it and watch it, who also get sucked into it in certain kinds of ways that are inescapable. And then everybody denying it,
Right, and I get the sense that, you don't play this moral, ethical value judgment piece in this when it comes to this life or any other life.
Yeah, right. Well, people are working, it's that thing that everybody says about the oldest profession. The idea that we can avoid or somehow get away from sex or having feelings about sex or being messed up about sex. It's crazy. So no, I can't make a moral judgment.
I'm thinking about this and your other characters as well. It's just like this is a beautiful piece in here, where Sandy, Debbie, the main character, is talking about her father, who she loved deeply, and his whole riff about the country is run by big men.
Mm-hmm.
You know the part I'm talking about, obviously?
Yes, I do.
I know. Do you want to read that? Or want me to read it? Or do you want to just share that for me?
I would actually much prefer you reading it.
Me?
Yes.
All right, fine.
I would like to hear it.
Okay, here we go. this, I'm going to put this out there because I want to talk about this because, I mean, there's so many pieces in here that really just reflect a way of looking at life. That's why I wanted to see what you're thinking of who these characters are to you.
Mm-hmm.
So she says, she says to her dad, "I don't understand, Daddy." He says, "This country is run by big men." He said, "There ain't too many of them. Most of the men in this land is little like me and all the other men and women on this block in this neighborhood. The big men put all the little people in cages so small that a little man or woman got to ask the big man to open the door just to turn around." He goes on to say, because the only way the little people could eat is to stay in that cage like the dude was really locked. Even if they just opened the door to turn around without asking, they don't eat that week. That's why I go out at night. That's why I run with bad men and do things they say is wrong, because I will not live in the big man's cage. I will not be his punk. I've read some of the other stuff you've written, your evaluation of society, some other books you've done, columns for The Nation, as well as all your other fiction books. And that is kind of a thread. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm like a guy who used to be an addict and a hustler, now runs a program, said to me, "Every man's got to have his job and his hustle."
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's true.
Right?
It's true, yeah.
And so, I mean, this cage, what is this cage?
Well, this is the organization, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, I mean, depending on, you know, we're all organized, you know, by economics, the infrastructure, by culture, by technology, and that's done regardless of who's, you know, supposedly in charge, you know, whoever has their name on the door, but these systems create structure, and we have to live in the structure in order for it to be able to maintain itself. And so rather than the structure of life being about us and our happiness, which is the only thing we're really interested in, it's more about keeping these systems going. In order to keep the systems going, people have to go into a cage that's not locked. They could open it anytime they want it. But if they do, they're going to be in trouble. If you open that cage, I'm not going to feed you. And so the idea is that, well, then I'll be on my own. I have to feed myself. Debbie's father, Sandy's father, says, "I would rather feed myself. I would rather put my life on the line knowing that I made my decisions about my life rather than have somebody else tell me how I should be living." And, you know, that's the way I understand modern culture, maybe even ancient culture.
Maybe culture, period. I mean, it made me think that there's this kind of bridge maybe in that philosophically there between the writer and the hustler outside.
Well, yeah, maybe, you know, but I mean, not necessarily. You know, the hustler could be working for the system, and
right,
the writer can be working for the
right
system.
It
depends, you know, it's like, it's very difficult to free yourself. It's like, you know, it's like if you get stuck in a spider's web, you know, you just get one hand stuck there, or the old, you know, the fable, the tar baby, you know, you put one hand and you know, if you put another hand on there, you have both hands stuck. You know, it's a tough thing.
You know, I read a couple of reviews of this book just mm-hmm. very quickly before we went on, very quickly. One of them was talking about how you created a character that, despite who she was empathetic and somebody you cared about. And I read that, and I thought to myself, wait a minute. But what is that saying?
It's that problem, you know, the problem of thinking, well, you know, if somebody is that kind of person, then they're bad, and they have to do something very special to be good. I mean, that's the whole history of being black in America, right? I remember I was talking to somebody once, and a guy said, "Well, you know, I don't mind black people. I wouldn't mind living next door to Martin Luther King," you know? And I said, "You mean somebody has to be Martin Luther King to live next door to you? I mean, you can't have like a dentist or a bricklayer?" And I said, and you know something? You'd be much better off living next door to a gangster or a pimp because, you know, nobody's going to blow up his house, you know? You know, but you know, it's a thing, you know, that, and you know, I'm not even sure that, you know, the reviewer was thinking about that.
Maybe not. That's just how I pull
it. But you know, but it comes out. Yeah,
I mean, and it's that what you mentioned, race in this book, though, is also, you've done this in other pieces of work, fiction and nonfiction, but in this book particularly, the race is clearly a factor in everybody's life, because it is, and there's no way around it. But also there's this connection between certain people, whether it's Theon and Sandy or Jude and Sandy, or, you know, and that the relationships are intense.
Yes.
And cross those boundaries.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the whole thing. You know, race is such, it's such a made-up thing, you know. I came up to this great realization the other day, Mark. You'll love this. You know, like, you know, people come up to me and they'll say, you know, do you think we live in a post-racial America? And, you know, and really, honestly, I've never had a person of color ask me that question.
So right.
I just want to start off there.
Right.
Do you think we live in a post-racial America? And I have a great answer now. I say, well, that depends. And they say, well, what do you mean? I says, are you white? And, you know, if they say no, well, I say, okay, fine, then you live in a post-racial America. I said, but, you know, I haven't met somebody who doesn't think that they're white. I don't believe in white people. I don't think they exist. I don't think black people exist. These are all made-up terms, you know, that you know, the colonists who came to North America made up because they were killing the red man and enslaving the black man, you know, and they called them red and black men. You know, Native Americans weren't red. You know, people from Africa aren't black, at least not all of them. And so, like, you know, it's a kind of a made up notion. And Debbie, you know, who lives so completely inside of her profession, she doesn't really have time for that. Most people don't have time for that. They're doing business, you know, and in doing business, you know, it's like, you know, well, we doing an interracial, we doing a big black woman and a little white man, or what are we doing? You know, I mean, and they don't care.
Right.
It's like, you know, and most people don't care. Once you get to know somebody, you don't care. You know, you don't say, you know, Joe the black man, you know, Mary the white woman. You just say, you know, Joe and Mary.
You know, when at that one point where, and I'll do this again here, that when Sandy's talking to Theon's mother, and who is, you know, by all accounts from the way she's described early in the book, a racist.
Yeah.
Right? But she says to her, no, Mrs. Pinckney, no, a lot of people love their hate. They live to hate the people wrong them. You can't just have one gang. That don't even make sense. If you took away the white man's black man, the black man's white man, most of them wouldn't even know how to walk down the street right.
Yeah, it's true.
I love this woman. She's just...
Yeah, Debbie's kind of cool. I really like her, you know. It was great to write about a female protagonist. One of the great things, when I gave the book to a reader, when I finished the first draft, and it was a guy, and the guy said, you know, I hate all the men in this book. And I went, wow, okay, great. That means I succeeded, you know, because you're seeing them from her point of view. And her point of view is not your point of view about what, you know, men and masculinity is. And I think that her strength is so wonderful. I'm so happy about her strength because, you know, she's not physically stronger than the people around her, but her will is so powerful. And her knowledge that, well, I'm always a step down, but that doesn't matter to me. I will stand up and fight for what I believe, you know. And, you know, and things she believes is not big political things or changing the world or stuff like that. She just believes in who she is, who her friends are, and who her family is. And she's hoping, you know, to resolve those issues, you know, before she has to die.
And you know, the it's also this, I think what's really important for her, for Sandy, for Deb, is that the love when she talks to her family for the first time in a long time, the power of love inside there is also very real. You know, it's very real. And I think that's important to get. I think that keeping the humanness of this woman, also her intellect. She's clearly bright. You got her reading a lot. You probably like all the books she put in her hand.
I like most of them, and I've read most of them. But, you know, the reason she reads is because when she was before six, her father read to her every night. After six, he had her starting to read to him. And so now, later in life, when she's reading, if for her, reading is an act of love. And that's why she loves reading. You know, it's not like she's an intellectual, like, you know, because she, you know, she has a kind of a college professor, John, for a while, you know, like, you know, hanging out with him. But he says that, you know, her understanding of reading, you know, wouldn't even work in the university, you know. And so she loses interest in him, you know, because she loves language because she loved her father.
She did. She did. I love the things when she goes off into her dream world a lot in this book. Whether it's a half daydream world or a serious dream, because that's an important world we occupy.
Well, yeah, we all do, right? Most of us, we're making up stuff all the time. We're living in our heads. And most of our, you know, the way that we talk about life is not that, because, you know, it becomes too complex, too disjointed. You say, well, but, you know, I'm trying to tell the story. I can't talk about her, you know, dreaming about, you know, something she was when she was a kid. But that's what people do. We're always dreaming. Right. We're always making up. We're always living in fantasies. That's the way life comes to being. And that's also what her industry does for all these people. All these people who are wanting to have sex and not having sex watch her having sex and identify with that, you know. Our life is so much dreams, maybe like 90% dreams.
Exactly, and we don't. And I think even a lot of writers, period, and people just don't pay attention, don't take that part of our life seriously.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult to deal with. It's very difficult to find the relationship between light and dark, you know, positive and negative space of, you know, how the dreams, you know, that unconscious place, and who I am sitting here, you know. It's a different thing. It's like most people, you know, people tell you that everybody, when they think about themselves when they were like 28 years old.
You know,
right. So you had this 72-year-old man sitting there saying, well, I'm remembering when I was 28. That's how I can justify asking this 22-year-old girl next to me, will she, you know, go out with me? Because I'm 28. I'm not 72.
Exactly. Right. Right. I remember my dad, it happens to me now, but my dad would always say, when he would always feel very young, he said, then he'd go to the bathroom and look in the mirror and go, what?
Who is that?
Who is that in that mirror? Now I ask myself that question. But I mean, and I think that part of it also is this, the whole book is also about this kind of, this one line in here about the rapacious sexual hunger of the Western world.
We so limit ourselves, we so put ourselves in those cages that, you know, the hunger is like, you know, it's almost all of us. We're like almost this yawning cavern of desires and hunger, you know, that you know, if we're allowed to develop, if we're allowed to mature, if we're allowed to live our lives the way we want it to. You know, I was giving a talk in Boston the other day, and one of the things I was saying is, in order to write, you have to write at least two hours every day. You have to write at least 2 hours every day. And the guy said to me, he said, well, you know, what if you can't? And I said, look, if you can't, you can't. So, you know, your kids, you get a job, you have responsibilities. If you can't find that 2 hours, there's nothing I can say. I understand. He said, but you have to remember that the world that you work for will steal every iota of your vitality for your entire life, and at the end they'll leave you an empty husk, and there won't even be a footstep behind you, not even one step, because they will have taken everything, you know. And I remember it saying it, because he came up to me later and he said, thank you for saying that, he says, because I've always suspected it, but I hadn't put it into words. And I think that you know, this is anybody who stops and says, I'm not doing it anymore. You see, I think nobody's ever going to think that about my book. So I get to say it to you. So maybe the people who hear your show will know it. That anybody who says, I'm not doing it anymore, that's a big thing. That's a big thing to say. I'm not playing your game anymore. You know, it doesn't matter if it's your mother, it's your best friend, it's your boss.
Mm-hmm.
You say, I'm not doing it anymore. You know, that's the thing, the Melville story says, I'd prefer not.
Right.
You know, Bartleby the Scrivener, yeah.
Right. I mean, that's part of what you talked about. It's tied directly to the cage.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm getting out of this cage. So, well, we're going to kill you. So, what? You could try.
Right.
I'm here. You want to try to kill me? Yeah, that's all right.
That's what Sandy does in this book. What Deb Sandy does in this book. I mean, whenever she confronts it, yeah, fine. Is that what it's like she's come to a place where, you know, I know I'm living a different life. I'm going to live a different life. You're going to pull that trigger? Well, then pull it.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, you can shoot me. The choice is if the choice is me going back in the cage, are you shooting me? And this is why the concept of slavery is actually, you know, it's impossible to be a slave unless you accept it. You have to accept it at some point. Now, there's lots of reasons to accept it. There's a lot of things like, you know, you can get brainwashed, you can get beaten, you can get tortured, you can get robbed from your homeland with no language, nothing, and no even memory of where home is. you know, lots of things that happen. But once you overcome those things and you say, listen, you know, I don't belong to you, you know, that's a new world. That's a new world. And that's what everybody's afraid of. Everybody's afraid of people saying that. All the religions are afraid of it. All the governments are afraid of it. All the corporations are afraid of it. And afraid of us saying, no more.
Right.
No more. Yeah, I've been writing this book, a new political monograph. You'll like it. It's called Folding the Red into the Black.
Folding the Red into the Black?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It has a whole bunch of meanings. But, you know, one of them is to say, well, let's dismantle capitalism and so-called socialism and just take the things that work, you know. And, you know, one of the things is, you know, we can do is, you know, we do all of that subsidies for, you know, for various foods, you know, grown.
Right.
You know, foods that are, like, really not good for us, like, you know, $77 billion in corn in 10 years. And there's also, we do beer and peanut butter and beef. And, I mean, there's about 10 or 12 big things. Billions and billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just saying, well, stop subsidizing, you know, agribusiness. Stop subsidizing, you know, fast food places. And, you know, just tell, you know, like they do in Cuba, say, look, a steak will cost you $20, but beans and rice cost you a penny a pound. You know, so, you know, if you don't want to, you know, go out and make the $20 for a steak, you can eat beans and rice. That'd be fine. You know, I'd be happy with that. You know, there are many ways that we can re-envision the world to make us happy. And, you know. And we're afraid. We're in those cages with no locks on the doors. You know, that's why they ended slavery. They ended slavery. They said, well, why should I have to take care of the slave when we have a bad year? Let the slave take care of himself. Let him maintain his own chains. So they did it in Russia. They did it in America. They did it in China. They did it everywhere. Freedom. But it's not really free.
No, I think that what you're describing now is what I think the consciousness struggle is coming up at this moment. I mean, that's mm-hmm. where we are.
Yeah. This is the thing. We say, what is life, you know? This is great. This is my notion, you know, Mark. I mean, I know we're going far away from Debbie, but it all works in it. I really honestly believe that we should tax robot labor.
Tax what? Robot labor?
Robot labor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, because, like, you know, you fold cardboard boxes for a living, right? And all of a sudden they come up with a robot cardboard box folder. It's going to be much better than you, no question. And then you lose your job. Well, but the robot is doing the job you used to do. It's doing a discrete job that a human being once did, and it's making a profit for the company.
Right.
That robot salary should be taxed. You know, and you just figure out what the salary would be, you know, based on what the human did. And there's no reason for most of us to work as hard as we do. This notion is like crazy, man. These people are like, they're like dying, you know,
right.
Working themselves to death with nothing to show for it at the end. And I don't know, you know, so like, but I mean, bringing back to Debbie, this is what Debbie realizes. She says, yeah, this industry is going to eat me up. I'm stopping. I'm not doing it anymore. You know, but it doesn't only have to be, you know, the porn industry. It could be anything. I'm not doing this anymore.
I'm talking to Walter Mosley. He's the author of more than 43 books, including the best-selling Easy Rollins series. His newest book is Debbie Doesn't Do It Anymore. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear the rest of my conversation with Walter Mosley. And on our way to break, we're hearing All Used Up by Utah Phillips, who left us on this day. 2008.
And there's songs and there's laughter and things I can do, and all that I've learned I can give back to you. I'd give my last breath just to make it come true. No, I'm not all used up.
As we come marching, marching, we battle to defend.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Utah Phillips and Annie DeFranco performing Bread and Roses. Utah Phillips, one of the great folk singers and activists in our country, passed away on this day in 2008. And I'm talking with Walter Mosley about his new book, Debbie Doesn't Do It Anymore. Walter Mosley is the author of over 43 books, including the best-selling Easy Rollins series. And thinking about the connection here, and there is a connection often between the way we think about writing our fiction and the way we think about writing the stuff we believe in that's political and nonfiction and our societal, the view of society. It's mm-hmm. almost like, you know, when between Deb and Sandy and reclaiming one's name in one's person, in one's place.
Right, exactly.
It's like Grandin, who wrote this really great book, Empire of Necessity, one of the things in the book he wrote about was that in slavery, people had their names taken from them. And so they became, as he put it, it was put back in the day, genealogical isolates, isolated from who they really are. They had to people should reclaim new names. And I was thinking about Debbie coming, trying to reclaim her name from the place that it was.
Yeah, reclaim her identity, which of course is a new identity. It's
not, right.
It has to be a new one. Yeah.
You know, you also have this great passage in here that because I know you love theater, and you have a new play coming out in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this, you have a character who, his quiet badness I love, Jude.
Yeah.
He is a bad boy.
He is.
Yes, he is. He said, I love the theater. The people there are so wrapped up in stories and how they look in those stories that they don't pay so much attention to you. It's like being in a thick forest where sound doesn't travel far and the sun is weak. It's like you're hidden so deep that you don't even know where you are.
Yeah.
I thought that's a great definition of theater.
Yeah, it is. And it's a wonderful, you could call it an escape, but it actually might be a discovery rather than an escape. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I like Jude. He's a good character.
He's really, I mean... Yeah, I mean, because you don't. I'm not going to give any of that away, but because you don't understand when she's talking about Theon saying this cat is bad, and she said, "What do you mean he's bad? He's not bad. He's this little wimpy guy."
Yeah.
So, and as you unfold, see who this human being is. It's great. I love the character that unfolds. Because you never know what lurks beneath.
Well, yeah, that's that thing, you know. It's not that the thing about you think you know, you think you understand, but you know, you can be terribly surprised. By your what you suppose is reality and what you suppose is the hierarchy, you know. I was talking to a big-time movie producer and a writer who had been a cop for a long time. And the movie producer was kind of, you know, he was kind of overbearing in a lot of ways. And he said, you know, I could do this and I could do that. And at one point the writer turned to him and said, but if you did that, I'd shoot you. And he was deadly serious. And like the producer, you could see, you know, because he had a fake tan, you could see it pale. And it's like, oh, I just made a mistake because this guy actually has a gun and I'm threatening him, thinking that my power is greater than his gun. And it isn't. And the guy, you know, he wasn't even being threatening. He was telling him a fact. He said, if you did that, I would shoot you. I go, oh, okay. You know. Well, you know, and I love that, you know, because there's a world out there. You know, you have to remember, you know, there's a world. The world's always changing, you know. This is why we're not like social animals, you know.
We're not social animals, you're saying?
No, we're like herd animals. We're like pack animals. We're like somewhere between sheep and gray wolves. You know, we struggle, we fight, we take over. We try to get. You know, each one of us tries to take over. We don't say, well, okay, that's the queen, that's the soldier, that's the drone, that's the one who goes out and gets the honey. You know, we don't know our jobs. We keep on trying to get better jobs. So, and when that guy gets weak, I'm gonna knock him over. I'm gonna take all his women. You know, and it's like, you know, that's who we are. You know, I mean, we can't help it, you know. So we have to live that life, not the life of a bee or an ant or a termite or something, you know, because we're not those creatures. Those creatures are nearly perfect in their communism, but we are not.
I mean, you know, you also have, and it reflects, I guess, kind of your look at the people who run the cage. But to me, it's kind of reflected in you have this deep respect for people in the street, people who have to kind of do what they can, be as loving as humanly possible, but have to address what life is like on the street.
Yeah, well, you have to survive, you know, and we all have to survive, you know. We're like, in one kind of way, we're all in the street, you know. But just some of us don't believe it, you know. Some believe that we, you know, we're somehow special, and But you know, the life we're living is a very difficult thing, you know. And there are things like, you know, the whole thing we're talking about getting older. We get old, and not only do we get old, we die. You know, we lose our strength. We lose our memories. We lose our abilities. You know, I used to be able to reach up on the shelf and get the can of tomato soup. Now I have to get somebody else to reach a can of tomato soup for me and say, "Hey, Junior, can you come here and hand me that soup?" You know, I mean, and it's kind of wonderful. It's kind of beautiful. That's what life is like. I had these guys helping me move once. They were all from the Dominican Republic, three guys, and they were brothers. And the youngest brother was now big and strong, and the oldest brother was old, and he could only carry one box at a time. The younger brother carried more than he should because when he was young, his brother had done this for him. There's such an interesting kind of notion about life and balance that we come up with, you know, that we forget, you know, in when we get in the throes of capitalism and you know, and money and wealth and power, so-called power. But all of it comes back to making the decision to live your life. And whether that's writing 2 hours a day, whether that's not doing it anymore, whether that's, you know, whatever it is, you know, just telling the truth once a day, you know, that is you being alive. And everything else is you being subservient to a much larger system.
And I think that, you know, the one of the strengths you give to Deb in this book, or Sandy, I mean, I don't know which name to call her, but
either one.
They're both names. But yeah. but she, part of her freedom, I mean, it seems to me that maybe I'm totally wrong about this, you can tell me. Mm-hmm. Part of her freedom from the porn to discovering at the very beginning of the book that, you know, Theon died and she had to figure out what was coming next and blah, blah, was the books. Was going from this street girl who loved books because of her dad, but her salvation was the books.
Yeah. Yes, and that's true. I mean, it's one element of her salvation. I mean, there's also her will, you know. When the guy comes up with her with the gun when she's in the bathtub,
yes.
You know, that's another part of it. You know, like, okay, you going to shoot me now?
Right.
Okay, go on, shoot. You know, and to mean it, to say, you know, listen, I'm out the cage, man. I'm out the cage. I'm in my bathtub. You need to shoot me, you go ahead and shoot me.
But if you shoot me, you're going to be in your own cage.
Yeah.
Right. No, that was a great scene. I mean, a couple of her bathtub scenes were very cool.
Yes, bathtub scenes are good. Bathtub scenes are good.
They're good scenes.
If I ever become a teacher of writing, I'll say, well, you know, you should always put a bathtub scene in your novel.
A requirement. Right, you got to do that. Not just Morning Smoke, I've always been a huge fan of your work. Just because it's so easy to read and it's so chock full of stuff. It's just, there aren't a lot of writers, I think, who can find depth and also a simplicity of writing.
Well, you know, that's I take that as a very high compliment. I've been thinking a lot about writing, you know, lately. That, you know, because my commitment to writing, and this is like not even to my audience, my commitment just to putting, you know, words on the page, is to make them as accessible as possible as I possibly can, you know, because the idea of telling a story. Stories are simple. You know, life is simple. Like I was saying before, you know, we're here to be happy. You know, that's the only real purpose that we have, you know. And, you know, and to share that happiness, you know, with other people, you know. And, you know, I believe in really complex thinking and figuring out things. I know all these words like epistemology and ontology and eschatology. I like them. You know, I like
right,
the notions.
Right.
But I like to say, well, but, you know, if somebody asks, what does the eschaton mean? I said, well, it's the doom. It's the final end of existence. You know, it's a, you know, and, you know, that just might be a big explosion, you know, bam, you know. And it's like, and, you know, and to be able to translate it down to that is, you know, it's wonderful, you know, and it's what makes, it's why we read. We also read because we love to read. I mean, we may love knowledge, we may love the experience, the escape, whatever. But it's the passion. Same thing that Debbie has when she's reading her books. I'm loving my father when I'm reading these books.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that, you know, I mean, that you say, we just said earlier, you say to people you write 2 hours a day, that every writer should write 2 hours a day at least just to keep rolling and keep it inside.
I actually write three, man. Actually, you know, okay. A lot.
Yeah. But that's important because part of that practice of writing is writing so that words flow.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean,
you can write
and put me to sleep. Not it's you, true. But I'm saying a writer can write and put you to sleep.
Yes. But if you do write every day, you will discover new things about yourself and about your writing that you never thought were possible. And that's why I tell people to do it. It's not like, you know, like it's some kind of exercise. It's not like, you know, it's not like weightlifting or something. Or you should do curls every day, get big biceps. That's true. You probably will. But the thing is that the writing is a whole other thing. It taps into the unconscious and it brings all this information out. And you begin to know yourself and you begin to know things that you didn't know you knew. And you begin to know things in a different way. Like when I'm writing from the point of view of E.Z. Rollins or Socrates or Maus, they say things that I would never say. I'm writing it, but I've put myself into that frame of mind. And in that frame of mind, I start saying things that, wow, I said, wow, that's really amazing. I was writing one day, it was a screenplay, and one guy, a black guy says to a white guy, he says, so you're talking about blood diamonds, you know, from Africa. And the guy says, yeah, you say blood diamonds. He said, but you don't say blood oil, blood groundnuts, blood wood, you know. He said, you know, who goes out shopping, you know, for some diamonds? I'm going out shopping for diamonds today. But you go out and shop for chocolate every day. And they all have blood on them. You know, it was so interesting because the character said that. I would have never said it. It certainly, obviously, I thought it. But I never realized it until writing it. And that moment of realization, as you see something through the lens of another character, that's it. It makes me very happy.
That's really important what you just said, because there are a lot of things that are inside of all of us. There's many things inside of all of us, ideas,
right.
People. So, and your characters allow them to be free, things you would never say to somebody else or think about is what you're saying.
Exactly. You know.
So what do women say about her to you?
You know, I've had like 25 different women read the book.
Uh-huh.
And they've all said different things. But nobody has complained that it wasn't, it didn't feel realistic from a woman's point of view, which is the only thing I'm worried about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of them like her. You know, they like her strength, you know, and they like her, and they understand her plight. They understand the plight of being stuck, because her being stuck, this thing of being stuck in the porn industry, it has ripples into everything that you're stuck in, you know. Like, you know, everybody is out there in the world, you know, like women know. At one point, you know, Debbie explains what she goes through every day just to do a porn scene, you know.
Right.
The 2 hours with the guy, the shaving of all of her pubic hair, this, that, the other thing. You know, women know that. You know, I remember I was Hillary Clinton after she lost to Obama. You know, and she's saying, "Yeah, he went out every day and played basketball." She said, "I had to go get, you know, made up and dressed. I spent those 3 hours in the morning." And you know, it was true,
right?
You know, it's like a woman can't go out there in the world looking like a guy. Oh, I threw on a shirt and a pair of pants, and here I am. You know. You know, I said, no, I got to get my hair done, my face done. I got to get just the right clothes. They have to fit in just the right way. And, you know, it's a whole other thing. You know, nobody ever complains about how guys are dressed.
Right.
Like, so, oh, did you see those brown pants he was wearing? Boy, that clashed with the yellow shirt. I said, nobody cares about that. They say, yeah, see, he's a real man, a man's man, you know.
That's true. And she reflects that, especially in her journey between the porn star and a new woman.
Oh, yeah. She said, I'm not doing that anymore. She says that, too.
Right.
I'm going to cut off this hair. I'm going to wear that schmata over there. You know, I'm not playing your game.
Right.
You know, I've been there.
And you use the word schmata in the book, too.
Yeah.
Yes, you do. So, I mean, the other part is, I think that I was curious about women thinking about was because the notion of pornography is kind of a metaphor for the sexuality of the world we live in, period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it is a lot like you hear women talking about when they talk about sex.
Say that again. So I make sure I understand.
The way you have Deb talking about how she views about sex and whether or not she even wants to have it anymore.
Well, it's a whole other thing,
right?
So it's like the she says I'm not doing it, but she has the younger boyfriend for a while, and he comes to the house and she says, listen, we can go, we can be in the bed together, we can talk, and but I'm not having sex. So if you need to relieve yourself, you can go to the other room and relieve yourself,
Right.
And so he gets up six different times to go to the other room because she's a very exciting woman, like he's just excited just to be there next to her. And so every time, every half hour or so, he needs to go, relieve himself, young man. And I just kind of I love that because that's it's a different way of seeing things, it's the guy's way of seeing things, which some men don't like because it shows their flaws, and it's the woman's way of seeing things, saying I really like you, but I've had enough sex.
Right.
And I've had enough sex. Now I need the company. And for a woman to say, I'm going to get what I need, that's a big thing. It's a big thing for men too, because we don't do it either. We don't do it in another way.
Right.
But to say it for women is another thing. Yeah, men are always fighting for freedom, and women, are always, supporting them or something,
And a lot of these men in this book are fighting for freedom.
Yeah.
In their own way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I look at these guys? I guess I wouldn't say I dislike all of them. But, but they all have their complexity to them.
Yeah.
At least most of them. Some of them are just jerks, but most of them.
Yeah, but even when they're jerks, they have their limits. Their jerkiness has its limits. And either Deb points it out or Jude points it out. Somebody points it out to him. Say, this is your limit right here. You've reached it. So you could try to get beyond that, but it's not going to work. and I kind of love that, And really, for me, it's great because being a guy, I know I'm not in charge. I know that. I know I'm not the best or the smartest or the whatever. I'm just not. I'm this guy in the world. With all these other people in the world, and to be shown that's a wonderful moment. To be shown your limitation is one of the best things anybody can do for you.
Right.
My father, when I was a kid, he said, Walter, if you want to do better than white people on the job, you got to come in. If you want to do as well, you got to come in a half an hour early and leave a half hour late. So if you want to do better, you got to come in an hour early and leave at least an hour later. And I said, but Dad, that's not fair. And he said, that's right.
That's right.
And that was the end of our conversation.
That's right.
It's like for somebody to tell you the truth, to tell you your limits,
Right.
You could be upset about it. You could be angry about it. You could be all a twist. So, but in the end, I'm telling you how either you're going to make it or you're not going to make
right.
it.
Right.
And that's like there can be no greater gift.
I agree. When growing up, I always told my daughters it's the line I stole from the Mississippi All-Stars in a blues song that they wrote. And I love this line. The line is, fair is only something you pay to get on the bus.
That's very good. I like that.
I love that line. I use it all the time now. I love that line. So this might sound a little off the wall, but so do your characters that you create in nonfiction like Deb and these other characters and the ones that you've made famous before her, do they flow into or affect your nonfiction writing, and I know vice versa.
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, because I kind of consider all writing the same. In an interesting way, it's harder to write nonfiction because it's easier to tell the truth in fiction than nonfiction. Like nonfiction is like because you end up lying by omission. You take a point of view and say, I'm trying to prove this point or that point. Like let's say you're writing a book about, the virtues of Ronald Reagan. You can write that book, and it could be a great book, but you have to leave out all the flaws of Ronald Reagan in order to do it, And we all do it. We do it about our heroes. We do it, we're going to write something about Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, or Angela Davis, the problem is that, to tell the truth, if you make up a character, well, you can say anything about them. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. and that's a kind of a wonderful moment, you know, when you're making up. So you have limits of nonfiction, but do they inform each other? Everything I write informs everything I will write from now on. So yes, it does.
Right, Mark. I can see that. I mean, I just think that I get this feeling reading this book, and I hope that. She'll probably be Sandy when she comes back, but I hope that she comes back.
We'll see.
I know you always say that.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know about her. You know,
you're not sure?
I mean, it's not genre, you know. It's not a mystery or crime novel, really.
No?
You know, it's a novel, you know, of a character following her, you know, path over a brief period of time.
She could
come back.
She
you know,
could.
I've been talking to Reggie Hudlin about doing a TV series about her. And so then, you know, then she'll come back in another way. You know, I'm doing some other things too. I'm doing Socrates Fortlow for HBO.
Was that happening?
Sam Jackson. Yeah, I think so.
Cool.
And then Sam Jackson is doing The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray also for HBO, which is really great as a movie. And so I've been doing a lot of that. A lot of coming back. People come back just in new mediums, you know.
I like that. But I could see her getting into all kinds of stuff.
Yes, no pun intended.
Right. No pun intended.
Yes.
But I can see that. I mean, she's just, you know, she's got so much there. And there's so many interesting people still revolving around her by the time you get to the end of the book. It's not like, you know, they're not, they're there.
Yeah, and also you have these people, like, you know, like it's like they support the world on their back, you know. And everybody hates them. You know, it's like, it's just so, like, you know, not hates them, but has somehow, like, you know, oh, that's too bad that you do that for a living, you know. But it's okay that your son goes out and murders people for a living for the U.S. Army?
Right.
You know, is that better? Is it, you know, this person has sex every day with people, you know, kind of, that you know,
kinda,
she doesn't
right.
hate or dislike. But your son and daughter are out there, you know, running drone planes, blowing up, you know, half innocent, half so-called guilty people. Like, I think having sex 1,000 times with somebody you don't like is better than murdering one person.
That's interesting.
Honestly.
That's interesting. That should be a bumper sticker.
Yeah, it's a long bumper
sticker. A long bumper sticker.
Put it on a T-shirt.
Very long. Yeah,
Put a T-shirt.
I mean, you know, there's enough in here to make anyone understand how disgusting on the personal side the porn industry can be mm-hmm. and what it is. But the power of this woman just comes through as her inner being that never leaves her, like a slave's inner being never left him or her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that is powerful. You even paint some people. I mean, the cop Perry is a very likable character as well. I mean, he becomes you can feel him as well. There's a lot in there with all these people. I just deeply appreciate everything you put into this book. I just got deeply into it. Didn't want to leave
you.
It. Which is why I'm saying bring her back.
Well, we'll see. Well, if I don't do it in another book, at least I'll do it in on the small screen. I think large screen might be interesting, but the small screen would be better because then we could watch her. You know, how does one actually survive after all this? You know, so, well, you know, I don't vote, but I've had sex with both senators, you know, male and female. You know, it's like, you know, that's. Like, that's kind of like, that's where you go with it. You know, there's all kinds of things that, you know, who are we? How does our world work?
Well, that's something you've been wrestling with in every book you've written.
Yeah.
So before I let you go, tell me, when does red in black? Red in?
Folding the red into the black.
Folding the red into the black.
I'm not sure. You know, I handed it over to Nation Books last week,
uh-huh.
and they're looking at it. They're actually going a different way. They may not, you know, it may not be like a subject they'd want to publish. But you know, over the next year, I mean, really, you know, and really, I will publish it somewhere. I haven't shown it to. Oh, actually, I have shown it to Paul Coates,
uh-huh.
so, and actually, I'm going to see him. So, like, you know, maybe Black Classic Press will be interested. You know, we'll see. You know, like, you know, it has to go somewhere though, because it's time to stop this crazy dialectic. You know, we call it a dialectic, but what it is people murdering each other for no good reason. You know, so I'm murdering you because you know you believe something different than I believe. I said, well, damn, that's that's not a good enough reason to kill me.
That has to end.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad your writing's not going to end. And I deeply thank you once again for taking your time out. And I've got your book reading tonight of Politics and Prose. I hope that goes well.
MLK Library, actually.
Politics MLK Library, is that where you're going?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, they're it's co-sponsored between the MLK and Politics and Prose tonight.
Cool.
And,
all right. Yeah. And, folks, I would encourage this book. We will link to it on our website. Debbie Doesn't Do It Anymore, the latest novel by Walter Mosley, and just an incredible read. Walter, once again, thank you so much for all your time and
thank you,
for
Mark.
Writing
it's
what
great
you write.
To be here.
All right, take
all
care,
right.
man.
Bye.
On our way to break, we're hearing Don't Walk Away by General Johnson, born on this day in 1943.